Are e-cigarettes friend or foe? I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
Everyone prior to that was doing the same thing every day and never stepping back.
What you're looking at on this machine is a robot that's picking up the parts and the scrap plastic at the same time.
By the time that we realized the mutation had crept up, it's at this point.
And
just
I think
too late.
That sort of shaming, blaming approach.
Every time I'm
when the wind pipes up, it stirs the ocean.
I'm convinced that lives could have been saved by deploying our technology more rapidly.
On today's show, hugging for better health. What's worse for corals, oil spills or the cleanup? And why figuring out the price for a colonoscopy is a major pain in the, well, you know. But first up, e-cigarettes. In the minds of consumers, they've been around for quite some time and sales exploded globally in the past couple of years. But public health officials are just beginning to untangle some basic questions about them.
They have the potential to do harm. They have the potential to do good.
So some see them as a great hope for smokers who want to quit. But critics worry e-cigarettes will get a new generation of Americans hooked on nicotine. A year ago, the government announced a proposal to regulate electronic cigarettes. Tanya English takes a look at the many issues involved.
When you puff an electronic cigarette, heat transforms the liquid and nicotine inside.
Once the e-liquid hits boiling point, when the coil heat up, it starts to evaporate or vaporize and turn into vapor. So it's going to make a little sizzling sound.
Nicotine buzzes the brain, and then as you exhale, white vapor pours out of your mouth. An electronic cigarette is just a metal tube attached to a battery and a heating coil. That's the basics. But at Delaware Vapor, shoppers come in for custom-built hardware and accessories. First-generation vape sticks looked a lot like traditional cigarettes. But these days, store manager Brendan Stiles sells bedazzled devices in Tiffany blue and hot pink. There's something to reflect any personality.
This is a vapor flask, so it's shaped like a flask. It holds tons of battery life. It has tons of power, you know, and it's comfortable in your pocket. It's comfortable in the hand. Yeah, leather wrap case says bad on it.
All the seats are full at the store's juice bar. That's where customers taste test e-liquids before they buy. Sheila Lakatosh is chatting with a barista and looking for just the right flavor.
Right now, I guess it's Papa Smurf, which is raspberry, blueberry, strawberry, whipped cream. Yeah, I know. I don't know. I've never done this before, so.
The 33-year-old has been smoking traditional cigarettes for about a year and a half.
Ex-boyfriend. Yeah, living together. Yeah, got me started. I'm like, well, let me just take a drag.
She ditched the boyfriend, and now she wants to quit her menthol ultralights.
Try something new, cut back on smoking, and eventually wean off of it. Bad habit.
That's the selling point. Style says smokers come in to switch from traditional cigarettes or at least cut back.
You blow out a cloud, you see that visual representation, your body receives nicotine. You know, it knows it's getting its nicotine fix, but it's not getting the 4,000 other chemicals that are in a cigarette, you know? And that's why these things work so well, you know? The patch, the gum, it satisfies the chemical craving, but it doesn't do anything for your physical, you know, habit. The actual ritual of smoking a cigarette, that's what people get really addicted to.
Back in 2009, the government banned all flavors except menthol from tobacco cigarettes. But at the vape shop, there are dozens of flavors to choose from.
I mean, if your e-liquid tastes like Robitussin, you're not going to quit smoking. You're just going to go back to your cigarettes, you know? You need to find a flavor you like.
You have to be 18 to buy electronic cigarettes in Delaware, and the law is the same in about 40 other states. But critics suspect that all those brightly colored bottles and flavors are deliberately designed to tempt teenagers.
Electronic cigarettes come in chocolate and butterscotch and even gin and tonic flavor. You know, if you're a teen, you can break two adult taboos by vaping gin and tonic or wine-flavored e-cigarettes.
So that's Robert Jackler. He's a researcher at Stanford University, where he tracks the messages and images used in vaping ads. He says lots of that marketing happens on social media, where minors can see it. Nicotine exposure can hurt brain development. And Jackler says in recent years, an increasing number of middle school and high school students have tried electronic cigarettes.
We would like that any claims to be science-based. Right now, it's completely unregulated. So you get overt health claims. There are e-cigarette products called Lung Buddy. There are those that say, breathe easier.
The federal government restricts claims about traditional cigarettes, but those limits don't apply to electronic devices.
You actually have doctors vaping e-cigarettes, reminiscent of the 1940s, more doctors smoke Camels than any other cigarette, complete hooey.
At the American Vaping Association, President Gregory Conley says anti-nicotine activists complain about vaping ads even when they are directed at adults.
CNN, which probably has less than 5% youth audience. And so for them, it's not just about youth. They see any marketing that is being done by vapor product companies as marketing to children.
Conley says e-cigs are a safer, if not safe, alternative for adult smokers.
It's important for them to learn about these products.
Serious science is on the way to assess the benefits of electronic cigarettes, but a lot of that research is in the early stages. Tobacco researcher Thomas Eisenberg says regulators need good research before they can make good rules to protect kids and help smokers quit. He says he studies electronic cigarettes as an alternative because smoking is more than just a habit. It's a drug-induced dependence, a brain disease.
If e-cigarettes are to have a place in the public health landscape in the United States, it's that they are A, less risky than tobacco cigarettes, cause less death and disease. I don't know that that's true, but a lot of people believe that it's true. And number two, they're going to help tobacco cigarette smokers stay away from all tobacco cigarette smoking for the rest of their lives.
Lots of smokers say they feel better and breathe easier when they switch to an electronic cigarette. So researchers at Creighton University in Nebraska are testing that idea. Siobhan Washington Krauth and her team recruited new e-cigarette users, then monitored their lung function.
We were fortunate enough to run into a vape shop owner who was very excited about the concept of people wanting to research e-cigarettes without necessarily trying to vilify them.
Vapers came into the lab to blow into a tube.
What they do is they take a nice deep breath in, fill their lungs as much as they can, and then they're going to forcefully exhale into this machine. So they're trying to push all the air out that they can get.
At the end of 6 months, the average pack-a-day smoker was down to just 5 tobacco cigarettes. Once again, Washington asked them to huff into her machine.
The amount of air a person can very quickly exhale, that's like really fast. Even though a large number of these people were still both smoking and vaping at 6 months, their lung function in this particular area was getting better.
So those are two big questions. Are marketers targeting kids? And does switching to e-cigs improve a smoker's health? Researchers are also trying to figure out if it's dangerous to breathe in secondhand vapor. To understand that worry, let's go back to the shop in Delaware. It smells delicious in there.
What's that click that I keep hearing?
That is our smoke eaters that we have up in the ceiling. Uh-huh. We have two $3,000 units running to sort of eat the vapor in the air, or else it gets kind of cloudy in here.
Health researchers have found preservatives and nicotine in those clouds. But industry lobbyist Greg Conley says the real question is, how much? Just trace contaminants are enough to actually do harm to bystanders. Mitch Zeller directs the government's Center for Tobacco Products and uses the technical term for e-vapor. He calls it aerosol.
Right now, I can't tell you what's in the aerosol. And that's why we say it's the wild, wild west for e-cigarettes. I'm the regulator, and I can't tell you what's in the aerosol.
If the Food and Drug Administration decides to step in this summer and regulate electronic cigarettes, Zeller will be the one in charge. He wants Americans to have an open mind, but says there's no doubt that nicotine creates addiction. Still, what kills people is puffing burnt tobacco leaves and the chemicals in that smoke.
Those are the compounds linked to cancer, heart disease, and lung disease, not the nicotine. It's not the drug. It's the delivery mechanism. And there really needs to be a societal debate about the role of nicotine, and e-cigarettes really has become the poster child.
For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Last year on the show, we met Temple University biologist Eric Cordes just as he embarked on a mission to the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico.
We are looking at deep sea corals right outside our porthole here. Over.
That was Eric Cordes calling us from the submarine Alvin, deep from the ocean floor. He studies corals and has been researching the impact of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. He's back now in the studio together with his doctoral student, Danielle D'Elia. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks for having
Thank
us.
Thank you.
Eric, give us a little bit of the background. You started studying the health of these corals before the Deepwater Horizon accident happened and have been following this issue over time, right?
Right. I mean, that's one of the ways that we initially got involved, because we were some of the only people who had this background information, this sort of pre-spill baseline to fall back on and to really know what you're looking at when you go down there. So we have been working in the area for maybe 15 years. I have been involved in deep coral research in the Gulf, and we had some sites in the area, and we went back and took a look, and it was sort of inconclusive what we found. And then we spent a lot of time exploring the immediate area around the rig. We've now found three or four sites that have definitely been impacted by the spill.
Now, of course, the first thing that comes to mind is the impact of the oil itself. How did that change the health of the corals?
So we found a large area of the seafloor that had oil on it, and there are a few coral sites within that, and the corals at those sites were covered in oil when we first found them. They were beginning to degrade. There's tissue falling off of the skeleton. They were in really bad shape, and that led to some of these other studies to follow up and see what it was that was actually causing this effect, and how oil or this dispersant that was applied in the spill is affecting the health of the corals.
And Danielle, talk a bit about the dispersant. How does it work? How is it used? How much of it is used with a spill of that size?
I know it's usually applied at about 1-10 ratio. I believe approximately 2 million liters of dispersants were applied. The dispersant helps to act as an emulsifier to help break up the oil and hopefully spread it throughout the water column a little bit better.
What are the dispersants made of typically?
The dispersants are a mixture of chemicals, one of them being DOS that we did actually detect in that brown flocculent material that were found on the corals at our impact sites.
And what did you find when you looked at the corals? How were they affected by the dispersant?
So in some of our experimental studies, it seemed that the corals did a lot worse when dispersants were applied, either in combination with oil or just by itself. So the corals exhibited similar signs of stress that we see on the seafloor with some of the imagery and studies that Eric was talking about, where you have tissue falling off the skeleton, you have kind of dying polyps that are retracted, they're no longer feeding. The tissue can be discolored. They're excreting a lot of mucus. So they're definitely not healthy corals.
And what is the thinking in terms of how long these effects will last? Can they be reversed?
Well, we've been going back and revisiting these sites every few months since the spill happened. And we've been taking images of the exact same corals and following their trajectory over time. And the corals that had really heavy damage initially are not recovering and getting worse. And a few of the colonies that only had very light damage seem to be sort of recovering and even regrowing over the skeleton where they were damaged. So it's sort of a mixed story. For the time frame, you know, if they can recover, hopefully they'll get back to health in a matter of years. The corals that were really heavily damaged, some of them were probably in the order of 400, 500, 600 years old.
What is the role of corals? What makes them important to the overall system?
That's a great question. It's something that I get asked a lot, and I struggle to answer. There are a lot of ways that we think they play a role in the greater ecosystem. They're visited by fish that migrate up and down through the water column every day, and they provide food coming down to the corals that's sinking from the surface. But we think some of these fish interact down there on these deep water coral reefs and then bring nutrients back up to the surface. There are large predators that come down and visit and may feed there and then export some of that to the surface. So we think there are these really broad connections, but no one's really demonstrated that, really quantified it. And that's something that we hope to do in the future.
And Danielle, what do you think will be the takeaway from what you found in terms of the use of dispersants in future accidents?
I hope that it will prevent people from just quickly applying these types of dispersants to communities where the toxic effects aren't well known, and kind of encourage people to come up with more natural, less toxic dispersants in the event of another oil spill.
Is there such a thing? Is there any research being done on a better dispersant?
Yeah, there is research. Within the same consortium that we perform our research on, there's other people who focus more on the chemical aspects of things. And there are more natural dispersants using components of cactus as a natural dispersant. Again, still acting as that emulsifier, but in a more natural way where it can be degraded in the environment without causing toxic effects on organisms. And I think that that is the way that the research needs to go, instead of just relying on what we already have and trying to understand that different environments may need different types of cleanup methods.
Thank you both so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Eric Cordes is an associate professor of biology at Temple University. Danielle D'Elia is a doctoral student who conducted the research on dispersants. Coming up on The Pulse.
It's a service that often people are surprised by in terms of getting unexpected sticker shock.
And the price tags are all over the place. Stay tuned to The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence believes in living like nothing can hold you down. But to live worry-free, you need someone to fall back on. That's why they offer doctors and hospitals across the region and a range of health plans designed to help fit your budget. Independence is here to help. This year, you may be eligible for financial support. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. More information at IBX.com or 1-800-ASK-BLUE.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca is committed to building healthier, more vibrant communities through disease education and awareness initiatives, access to affordable medicines, and partnerships with nonprofit organizations across the Philadelphia region and beyond. In 2014, AstraZeneca donated $18.5 million to nonprofit organizations for programs and projects aimed at improving health across the U.S. Learn more at AstraZeneca-US.com.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mikan Scott. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, Mikan.
Carolyn Beeler, what's going on?
I just wanted to give you a hug.
Okay, that was nice. What's happening?
Hugs are really good for you, so I just wanted to give you one.
All right. How so? Sit down. How are hugs good for you?
Yeah, it may sound a little crazy, but hugs are an indicator of strong social support. There's a lot of evidence that links strong social support to better physical health. So if you have supportive friends and family, the negative effects of stress on the body are sort of canceled out when you have support. So hugs are part of these strong relationships. There's this psychologist at Carnegie Mellon. His name is Sheldon Cohen, and he studies this protective effect of social support on the body.
Social support acts as a stress buffer. What that means is that if stress puts you at risk for disease, then having high levels of social support seems to protect people from that risk.
Strong social support is thought to outweigh the negative impact stress has on the cardiovascular system and immune function and reduce stress-related disease.
This, of course, leads us to the idea, well, is there a simple intervention that might impact people's perceptions of social support or their protection from stress?
Scientists don't know much about which words or actions effectively convey social support. So in a study published this year, Cohen ran an experiment. For 14 days, his researchers asked study participants,
have you had a conflict or tension during that day? And did anybody hug you today?
Then the participants were injected with a cold virus. As expected, people with more social conflict were more likely to be infected. But if they had more social conflict and more perceived social support, that increase in infection risk was wiped out. And hugs were a main factor in that perceived social support.
About a third of the people who are protected by social support are protected either because of the hugs or because the hugs are an indicator of kind of the intimacy of their social relationships.
Cohen's team also had another finding which surprised him. When people were already infected with the virus, being hugged was correlated with fewer symptoms of illness, whether they were stressed out or not.
So there's clearly are effects of these two factors that are independent of one another.
In other words, there could be some special ingredient in a hug that helps protect people from getting sick, apart from reducing stress. This experiment adds to a 2007 study done by Beata Ditzen, a medical psychology professor at the University of Heidelberg in Germany. She studied women's stress reactions after mock job interviews and mental math tasks.
We tested 75 women, and we tested them in three different conditions.
A third of the women did the test alone, another third got verbal support from their male partners, and the rest got shoulder or neck massages. After the test, Ditzen measured heart rate and levels of cortisol, a stress hormone that suppresses the immune system.
Those who received the massage showed the lowest stress response in cortisol and in heart rate. It clearly suggests that physical touch can reduce the stress response, at least in romantic couples.
Of course, relationships can also be a major source of stress. Research shows negative relationships provide the most potent kind of stress and the health consequences that go along with it. Managing both good and bad relationships is important to physical health. But University of Utah psychology professor Bert Uccino says it's hard for doctors to talk to their patients about their social lives.
To a certain extent, I think some people view their relationships as being private. And so it's difficult to tell people you should get rid of these certain relationships because they're bad for you and cultivate these other ones because they're good for you.
I think right now there's not as much focus.
That's primary care physician Susanna Evans.
We all are asking everybody every visit about smoking. And I think we're getting to the point where we'll start to think more about including that social piece as we sort of evolve these ideas.
Evans says she already asks patients in her West Philly office about friends and family when she's taking a medical history, and she revisits the topic if it's relevant.
It's interesting, as we were just talking about that, I just think of a patient that I had who moved here for work from San Diego.
She had lived in San Diego her whole life, and after moving to Philadelphia, kept getting sick. The patient visited Evans for four ailments in less than 3 months. A sore throat, musculoskeletal complaints.
Various illnesses. And then after a while, we really got to talking about the fact that probably a lot of this was stemming out of her feeling alone here in Philadelphia and still trying to make the transition.
In addition to treating each illness, eventually Evans recommended she join a running club to make new friends. Sheldon Cohen believes doctors like Evans who ask about friends and family during office visits are rare, largely because the fix for loneliness or a stressful relationship can't really be written on a prescription pad.
And it may be fair that we don't see that much because we don't yet have a good enough understanding of how to intervene to change these things.
That's why Cohen is studying hugs, to find simple recommendations doctors can give their patients to strengthen good relationships and keep stressful ones in check. Maybe a prescription for hugs isn't so far off. For The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And hey, do you want to receive a virtual hug from The Pulse every week? Sign up for our newsletter at whyy.org/pulse-newsletter. All right, on to the final frontier, space. Last week, NASA formalized plans for a rendezvous between an unmanned spacecraft and an asteroid. Two aspects to this plan. Priority number one is to test a solar electric propulsion system, whatever exactly that is, that will be necessary for a future trip to Mars. Goal number two is protecting mankind from extinction by asteroid. Now, if avoiding human extinction is more important to you than getting to Mars, this next story is for you. Here's Todd Bookman.
NASA isn't sure yet which asteroid it's going after. Researchers need to consider orbit, rotation, and shape, but the likely choice will measure a few hundred meters in diameter.
It's a what we would call a medium-sized asteroid. It's not huge, but it's medium, and it certainly is an asteroid that would pose a great threat if it should ever be on a collision course with the Earth.
Paul Chodas manages NASA's Near-Earth Object Office at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California. He says once they select the asteroid, an unmanned spacecraft will head toward it, arriving sometime in the mid-2020s. It will attempt to pluck a boulder off the asteroid's surface, then it will just kind of hang there.
Hover above the asteroid for several months. During that time, it will try to move the asteroid.
Move it without touching it. Use the gravitational interaction to nudge the thing off its orbit. It's a skill we should have down pat because we may need it in the future. We've certainly needed it in the past.
In 1908, on June the 30th, there was a massive explosion over Siberia.
The region of Tunguska sees the biggest explosion in human history.
Eyewitnesses described a sky split in two, the clouds spewing flames, and then a hot wind topples 80 million trees. Many in Russia panicked at the sound and headed for religious shrines. The asteroid explosion was 1,000 times stronger than the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima. A century later, we get a glimpse of that power, again in Russia, in the city of Chelyabinsk. This is Jose Luis Galache.
And we have a lot more information about this asteroid because it was captured, as your listeners probably have seen, captured on many dash cam cameras that drivers in Russia have in their cars.
Countless videos show a fireball streaking across the dawn sky. The shockwave breaks thousands of windows and injures 1,500 people. Galache works for the Minor Planet Center in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Since 1947, the group has been cataloging asteroids, keeping track of more than 675,000 of them.
So if a new asteroid is discovered that's on a collision course with Earth, we are the first people to know about that.
But they didn't have the Chelyabinsk asteroid on their radar. No one did. The Minor Planet Center does, however, keep an eye on other potentially hazardous asteroids and updates a list on its website.
So I haven't actually checked today, but I think we're closing in on 1,400, I believe. And they're called potentially hazardous, and people tend to concentrate on the hazardous part of the acronym. But I'd like to stress that they're potentially hazardous.
Assuming these follow their orbits, the math puts them a safe distance from us. But if one were to somehow speed up or slow down or get elbowed off its track, that's the hazard. Galache isn't worried.
As has been said, it's the only natural disaster that we can actually do something about because we can't stop hurricanes or tornadoes or earthquakes. But if we discover an asteroid that's on a collision course, there are many options and we can probably stop them. Of course, we have to find them first.
NASA spends $40 million a year looking for asteroids. Its focus has been tagging very large ones, more than 1 kilometer in diameter. The agency says it's identified 96% of what's believed to be out there in this size range and confirms that none pose a risk to Earth, at least over the next 100 years. Smaller and medium-sized asteroids are a different story, in part because they're so hard to see.
If you've ever seen a meteorite, which is a piece of an asteroid that's fallen on Earth, you'll know that they're dark-colored. They're almost the color of charcoal. So in space, you're looking for dark objects against a black background.
Astronaut Ed Liu flew 3 missions to the International Space Station.
And that's why we haven't found the great majority yet of these asteroids. We don't know where the great majority of them are or where they're headed or whether or not any of them is going to hit the Earth or when.
Liu now directs the B612 Foundation, which is attempting to launch its own privately funded detection system. It's called the Sentinel Space Infrared Telescope, and it would map the inner solar system, where at least 500,000 asteroids may move unseen. With enough lead time, any of those that pose a risk could be moved off target with what Liu calls fairly simple technology.
Unlike in the movies where they use nuclear weapons and oil drillers, you don't need to change the velocity very much. And that means it's something as simple as running a small spacecraft into the asteroid. That's basically sufficient in the great majority of cases to prevent an impact. And that's something that we know how to do.
If the asteroid still has years left to travel before impact with Earth, changing its speed by just a fraction of a mile per hour would move it off course. NASA's redirect mission is in a similar vein, using gravitational interaction to shift the orbit. But NASA isn't contributing money to the Sentinel Space Telescope project. its $450 million price tag is being raised completely from donations from citizens of the world that see the value in an expanded asteroid detection effort. Which brings up an interesting question. Of all the things you could donate your money to, all the charities and hospitals and public radio stations and universities, where does planetary defense fall on your priority list? I mean, we should all know by now what will happen if we don't spot these asteroids in time. We've had plenty of warning.
You know, the popular consciousness is aware that an asteroid has killed off the dinosaurs and that asteroids have hit the Earth and have destroyed a lot of things on this planet repeatedly.
That doomsday scenario has been reinforced and reimagined in countless books and movies like Armageddon and Deep Impact. And maybe it's Hollywood's preference for exaggeration or pseudoscience, overly sappy endings, that keeps us from acting with more urgency. Maybe we've grown numb to the risk. Or maybe it's just that nobody wants to be Chicken Little.
I'm curious, do you ever hear negative feedback? Like, maybe this is a little nutty or beneath a man of your intelligence?
Well, when you hear things like that, it's usually from people who basically have never looked at the odds. Because the real question is, should somebody somewhere on this planet be trying to solve this problem? My answer to that is yes. And I'm just one of those people.
For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
We are stars. We are golden. We are good.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. It just may be easier to move an asteroid than to find out how much a medical procedure is going to cost you before getting the procedure done. This is an issue we've been exploring on The Pulse.
So I called around to a lot of different hospitals to find out how much amniocentesis cost.
How much was the CT scan going to cost?
No one would tell me.
And the two nurses just looked at each other in shock, like, we don't know.
I ended up getting a bill a month later saying that it was $1,000 more.
It could put me in overdraft or serious financial difficulty.
We've launched an initiative called WHYY Price Check together with a company called Clear Health Costs. And what we're trying to do is create some transparency around the cost of medical procedures and around medical bills. People have been sharing information on our website at whyy.org/pricecheck. You put in information there on how much you paid, how much your insurance paid. The result that's starting to happen is a searchable database where you can check out how much procedures cost in our region. We've gotten over 100 entries so far. We're hoping for many more. Alana Gordon now has an update on one very common procedure that often has surprise expenses going along with it.
More than 10 million people get this each year. It's a really common screening tool for those who are over 50.
Especially the prep is not, very enjoyable. I'm trying to postpone it.
Patricia Carmona is talking about the colonoscopy.
Because I have some history of colon cancer in the family. So it's like a routine checkup for me.
Routine, perhaps, but the prices are far from it, depending on the details of the procedure and the items that get billed. In this region, prices appear to be all over the map, ranging from $800 to $8,000. That's based on information from a dozen people who entered what they were charged and what they paid for a colonoscopy into WHYY's Price Check database. For Patricia Carmona, who was one of them, she learned that prices can vary the hard way.
The total bill was $10,000. I was shocked because I didn't know. I thought that a colonoscopy was a colonoscopy and there was a rate that didn't vary by provider.
Carmona hadn't paid attention to cost or where she went until she had a colonoscopy recommended by her doctor under a new insurance plan. It meant she had to shoulder more of the cost of her care, 20%. She was unprepared for the bill she got afterwards for the procedure. Did I say bill? I meant bills.
So I was shocked when I got the different bills. I called them and I said, why are you charging me twice? Because it seemed they were charging me twice. But then they explained that, no, that's how the way it works.
Medical bills are complicated. Experts say the system is designed in a confusing way. But Carmona's experience is a common one for colonoscopies.
You get different bills for the physicians.
So those are the doctor fees.
One is the anesthesiology. Then I got the physician that did the colonoscopy. The other one is the pathologist.
Who examined a biopsy they took. She had another related procedure.
It's a long bill.
The doctor fees came out to more than $3,000. But those are the list prices. Her insurance rate brought those down to about $2,500. She then paid about $500. That wasn't it. The big charge was for another $7,000.
So the hospital charges you for what they call the facility fees?
Carmona showed me this in her explanation of benefits. The facility fees listed for her at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital, where she went, included the use of the operating room, the recovery room, the pharmacy, and the lab. Now keep in mind that $7,000 charge was a starting point.
So at the end, I think the negotiated rate was $5,900. And the insurance paid 80% of that, and I had to pay the rest.
About $1,100 out of pocket, again, just for those facility fees. The hospital turned down an interview request, but Richard Gundling with the Healthcare Financial Management Association says these facility charges are common for colonoscopies, and they're often higher at big hospitals compared to outpatient facilities.
You know, academic medical centers may have a higher true cost of providing that service because of the greater facilities and, you know, staffing and those types of things that they have compared to maybe an outpatient center that may have a lower cost but may not be able to do quite as complicated cases.
Gundling says hospitals often structure these fees in a way to cross-subsidize other health services and charity care and research. And again, these prices are not uniform. Hospitals and providers have individual contracts with insurers. Neil Shaw is a doctor and professor at Harvard who studies health costs. He says there's another reason why prices for colonoscopies and other medical procedures generally vary from one place to another.
You know, it's just sort of the market at work. It's the same reason why, you know, different restaurants can charge different amounts for a hamburger.
Okay, a colonoscopy, not quite a hamburger.
The difference is with a hamburger, you kind of know the quality of what you're getting as soon as you bite into it. With a colonoscopy, it's much harder to know the quality. But one thing that we know at a high level in the United States is that usually the price and the quality aren't well connected.
And you often don't know the price beforehand. Shaw says with colonoscopies especially, people may encounter unexpected sticker shock. Insurance may cover it if it's a preventive screening, but
the trick is if you find something that is suspicious and needs a biopsy, that biopsy might be billed separately.
As for Patricia Carmona, she says she learned her lesson after getting those colonoscopy bills.
Ever since that moment, then I started, every time I had a procedure or I had to go to get an X-ray or whatever, I always called ahead to try to get an estimate of the pricing.
Carmona's doctor tells her she's actually due for a colonoscopy again soon. This time around, she says she'll be asking up front about those facility, physician, and anesthesia fees.
But it's still a struggle. It's really hard to get this information.
For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
And Patricia will be following up with you to find out what happened. And also, please keep on putting that information into our database so we can get better and better information. What did you pay for a colonoscopy? What did you pay for a mammogram, for an MRI? Go to our website, whyy.org/pricecheck. It's really simple and really quick. Coming up on The Pulse, whatever you do, don't look up.
You have to essentially keep your nose pointed at the floor for at least 23 hours out of every 24 hours in a day.
The story of a rough recovery, still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse and believes that everyone should make the most of every moment. That's why they offer doctors and hospitals across the region and a range of health plans designed to help fit your budget. More at IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca is dedicated to improving health in communities across the Philadelphia region. On Twitter at AstraZeneca US or on Facebook at AstraZeneca US Community Connections.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Earlier on, we talked about e-cigarettes and efforts to understand their health impact. Now, this update on old-fashioned tobacco cigarettes. The FDA wants to use graphic photo labels on cigarette packs that highlight the dangers of smoking. They've been used in other countries for years. Picture rotting teeth, black lungs, cancer of the mouth, this kind of image. In the U.S., an attempt to get these images on cigarette packs was derailed in 2009 by industry complaints, saying there wasn't enough evidence to support their use. Since then, researchers have looked for more science on whether these images work or not. Some of this research is being done at the Annenberg Center for Public Policy, and I stopped by to talk to Associate Director Dan Romer.
It turns out that a lot of the research that had been done that supported their use was done in countries where they were just implemented, and then they follow to see what happened. And when they do that, there's often other things that go on, so like taxes go up and other media campaigns. So it's hard to know what the effect is. FDA is now being required to demonstrate much more carefully in experiments where we randomly assign people to different kinds of warning labels and find out what the effects are. They're going to really need to do that. And so that's started to happen, and we've been doing work on that. In particular, showing people warning smokers, warning labels while they're in a fMRI machine so we can see what's going on in their brains. And it turns out that we've found that these pictures that are more emotional, that illustrate the risks a lot more clearly, actually do influence smokers' brains in ways. They register in areas of the brain that suggest that people are remembering these images. And they also remember seeing them 20 minutes later. They can pick out the ones that they saw versus ones they didn't when they had these more emotional pictures. So we're starting to get evidence that these images are effective. Smokers also say they're less willing to smoke after seeing them, certainly more effective than the warnings we have on the side of the pack today.
Describe perhaps one or two of the images that were used in this study.
Well, there are images showing diseased lungs. That's a particularly strong image. There's images showing people reacting to secondhand smoke. And, you know, they really bring home the idea that this is a harmful habit. And we're hoping that this will, when it eventually does come to pass, that this will remind smokers and encourage them that this is an unhealthy habit and it's time to get going on the quitting.
Is there any way to test whether or not these images will become wallpaper over time? They are shocking the first time, right, a little bit less shocking the second time, exactly, and so on. It wears off.
Yeah. So we've actually done a study where we've given smokers their own brand of cigarettes with these warning labels for a month. And we found that, yeah, there might be some wear off, but what actually does happen is they learn more about the hazards, and they start thinking more about quitting. That's only a month, but it's a lot longer than a lot of other studies that have been done.
What might happen next as more evidence comes in on these labels?
Yeah. Well, the hope is that FDA will be able to show with studies like the ones we're doing, other people are doing studies, that these emotional pictures that they selected, or they might need new ones, but that these are more effective than just having text, and that we can justify to the courts that from a public health perspective, this is the appropriate way to warn people. You don't just want to have a few words on the side of the pack or even on the front of the pack that can be ignored. You want to have a picture that gets people's attention and illustrates the risks.
Dan Romer is the Associate Director of the Annenberg Center for Public Policy.
I turned my camera on. I cut my fingers on the way. On the way.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and it's time now for our series, Patient Files, your stories of coping, healing, and recovery. Fair warning, though, today's edition is not for the faint of heart because eyeballs are at stake. This is the story of how Chris Cetullo, Vice President of News here at WHYY, almost lost his vision in one eye. The story starts on the Pennsylvania Turnpike. Chris was on his way back from picking up a brand new pair of glasses, and then he noticed something was off.
Why is everything weird and wavy, and why can't I see?
Chris is no stranger to serious eye problems. He's had a few retina tears, and a visit to his eye surgeon revealed he had a macular pucker. That's a wrinkle or tear in the macula, the oval-shaped area near the center of the retina. His surgeon said,
"You need a vitrectomy." They take out the vitreous, which is the gel in the middle of your eyeball. They basically empty out your eyeball so that they can get at the retinal wall at the back of your eye.
After the procedure, doctors fill the eye with a gas bubble that has to press against the wall of the retina to allow the eye to heal. To keep the bubble in place, patients have to be face down.
You have to essentially keep your nose pointed at the floor for at least 23 hours out of every 24 hours in a day. So you have to sleep in that position, eat in that position, basically live in that position.
For however long it takes for the eye to heal. For this part of the adventure, patients usually rent a special chair. Picture a massage chair.
You sort of kneel on it and put your face down in a cushion, and that enables you to basically live the face-down lifestyle.
The chair also has a mirror that allows people to see things even though they are face-down. For example, the television.
So luckily, the surgery happened in the middle of March Madness, so I had a great deal of NCAA basketball and spring training baseball to watch. So I wasn't all that upset about this. I forget, this would pass the time. And we rented a lot of movies and things, so I was just going to spend a lot of time listening to audiobooks, watching sports, and watching movies. So I remember the first night I was there, there was no pain, really. March Madness was on. I watched a couple of basketball games. As I recall, that was the night that Lehigh upset Duke, so I was happy with that. And, you know, I thought, fine. So the next morning I woke up, and I was like, wow, you know, the eye is still, like, I really can't see a thing out of this. But I thought I was supposed to be able to see the gas bubble. But I had some people had this procedure before, and they said, well, it can be a little cloudy for a while. So I thought, okay, so it's a little cloudy. Well, during the course of the weekend, it kept getting cloudier and cloudier till it was like being in the midst of a bank of really thick London-style fog. Couldn't see a thing out of the right eye. So I called the hospital on the Monday, and they're like, get in here. So I come in, and there's a lot of poking and prodding and looking into my eye and a lot of sort of, you know, quiet conferences on the other side of the room. And they said, come down the hall. And so they sent me in another chair down the hall, and they said, well, you have an infection in your eye, and we have to take immediate action. And I said, well, what's the immediate action? They said, well, we have to get some antibiotics on the infection. So I sat in the chair for the next 2 hours while they stuck needles into my eyeball. It hurt like a son of a gun, each one of them. I think I had 3 needles, but I did manage to survive that. And then I went home, and they sent me home with, like, I don't know, a dozen different kinds of antibiotics. I don't remember. They're all these little things, and they were different. And I had to have those put into my eye round the clock. You know, I had this shield and bandage all over my eye, and I could not aim at all, like with my other eye, with my head up, to get the drops in my eye. So my wife had to do it for me, which meant that she had to get up throughout the night, every hour and the hour, to do this stuff. She got exhausted the first day. My daughter, bless her heart, drove down from the Lehigh Valley where she lives, came in, and they literally took turns like setting the alarm clock and getting up every hour to come down into the living room where I was face down in the chair watching TV or whatever to give me the thing. So that went on for 3 or 4 days. And then finally we had the big test, I think, on Friday. My surgeon was seeing me every day, you know, so I was clear that he was worried. You know, he came directly out of surgery one time in his scrubs to come see me, which hardly ever happens. But I'm not sure I was ever as clear as my wife was during this period what the stakes were. I am so terrible about medical things. And when doctors talk to me about what's going on with my body, it's like the thing in Charlie Brown, you know, when adults are talking, it's just wah, 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 wah. I didn't realize that I was very close to going blind in one eye. But came in on the Friday. He looked in the eye. He says, it's beginning to clear, and it's cleared enough so I can see back to the retinal wall. And actually, we've cured the pucker. So if we can get rid of this infection, you'll be fine. So remember, my wife and I, after leaving the doctor's office, and he'd had hours somewhere out in the suburbs that day, and we were out there. Remember, we went to an IHOP to have breakfast and celebrate the fact that I wasn't going to go blind. And those were the best pancakes I think I ever had in my life.
Chris Atulo is WHYY's Vice President of News, and he was recounting a difficult eye surgery he had 3 years ago. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Avery Brookins is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joe Patterson, our managing editor. Meg Pinto is our executive producer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or at our website at whyy.org/thepulse. And we always love to hear from you. Email us with your feedback, your story ideas, your questions at thepulse@whyy.org. Don't forget about those medical bills. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a generous leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands gladly support WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.